You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday the 29th of April 2020 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioalbion.com. Well, I watched the big debate yesterday as it was happening live. That's Andrew Anglin debating Greg Johnson about the coronavirus. Andrew Anglin's position is that this is just the flu and we shouldn't have taken any measures to try and mitigate the effects of this. And Greg Johnson's position is that this is a very dangerous virus and the government are correct in what they are doing, but they're incompetent in the way that they are executing it. And this is my position, is that the government have been completely incompetent in the way that they have dealt with this. They should have isolated Wuhan the minute we saw that China had isolated Wuhan. And I believe that both Andrew and Greg agreed on that point. The debate itself was very civil. They weren't shouting over one another, which is a breath of fresh air, really, with these sort of debates where you've got two people with very entrenched positions on either side. But I did feel that it could have been better. It really didn't satisfy me that either of them actually went into all of the points that they actually had. And there were two main points that each one made that the other one completely failed to address. And I just want to bring these up first briefly. The point that Greg was making is looking at the death rate. Now, I've been talking about the death rate recently, about how it's 0.1 or 0.2%. And that's based on the figures that we have from Iceland and from California, where they've tested 20% of the population, large numbers of the population, and found that only a small number have actually died from this. Now, obviously, there are probably a lot of deaths that aren't actually being recorded as coronavirus, because we now know that there are young people getting strokes, heart attacks, blood clots, all these sort of things that aren't actually being recorded. And we can see that there's a huge spike in deaths, far outnumbering the corona deaths in these countries that actually have it. Now, Greg wasn't looking at that figure. Andrew was making the point of looking at that figure. But what Greg was doing, he was adding up the total deaths to the total recovered number, which comes up with a very different death rate. If we look at America at the moment, America has total deaths of 59,000. And a total recovered of 142,000. Now, there are only two things that can happen when you get this virus. You can either recover from it or you can die from it. And if you add the total deaths there to the total recovered, you get 200,000, which is the total, and 59,000 people have died from that 200,000 total, which is actually a death rate of about 30%. Now, the actual total people with the virus at the moment in America is 1 million. So if that percentage remains the same, the total deaths from that 1 million we're currently up to, that it actually has in America, there will be 300,000 deaths, which is fairly close to the estimates that were actually given. I think they reduced the estimate to 200,000. And if it stays the same as it is now, it's going to be 300,000. Now, Andrew completely failed to address that point that Greg was making. And the point that Andrew was making that Greg completely failed to address was the fact that in Sweden, they haven't carried out anywhere near the lockdown measures that we have in America and in Britain and elsewhere in Europe, and yet they do appear to still have this very low death rate and low rate of people actually contracting the disease. And I really would have liked to have seen Greg answer that. And I really would like to have seen Andrew answer this death rate of about 30%, which is a huge difference to the 0.1% from just testing the people in the population. Neither of them addressed that. So that's why I say that I think the debate could have been better. One other point, it was supposed to be the umpire, or the moderator, was supposed to be Millennial Woes, and it wasn't. It was Tiina Wiikki from Finland. And this isn't a personal attack on Tiina, but I think the fact that she was female may have started this debate off in the wrong direction. And the reason why I say that is because right at the start, after Andrew and Greg both made their points, Tiina then asked each of them to find the point that the other had made that they agreed with. And the point of the debate is to find the points that you don't agree on and argue that point. And I would suggest that because Tiina is female, there is an evolutionary psychology explanation for her trying to find peace between the two of them. Because women have a lower body strength than men, they instinctively try to pacify situations. They instinctively try to get everybody to be friends. So subconsciously, she would have been doing that. So right at the start, instead of trying to get the debate going, she was trying to get them to agree with one another. When each one of them should really be trying to make their point and arguing for their point, not actually looking to find agreement. But she did a great job just as standing in. And she didn't interrupt too much, and she did ask good questions. It's just that I think that maybe that set it off in the wrong direction right at the beginning. But as I say, check out what Hunter Wallace has to say about it at Occidental Dissent. I pretty much agree with everything that he has to say there. I've got a news story that I want to get into today, a really interesting news story with a lot of lessons in it that I think we can learn. But just before getting into that, there's another thought that occurred to me. Today is Victory in Europe Day. It's 75 years since the end of the Second World War. And just that wording itself, Victory in Europe, tells you the truth about that war. It wasn't the victory of Europe, was it? It wasn't the victory of the Europeans. It was victory in Europe. So whose victory was it? If it wasn't the victory of Europe, that it was the victory of the international bankers who were funding Stalin, who were funding Churchill, who were funding Roosevelt, who were influencing all three of them, because the National Socialists cut out the international bankers. That was their crime. I'm not so sure it was even the mistreatment of Jews, because the mistreatment of Jews helped the Zionists, because they wanted the Jews to feel that they were being mistreated in Europe so that they would move to Palestine and they would be able to set up their country there. So I think even more so than Jewish loyalty to other Jews, it was about these international bankers who knew that their system was done for if National Socialism took off in Europe, which it had. I mean, each of these countries that the National Socialists liberated, they reformed the banking system. The middlemen were cut out entirely, which is where these international bankers, where they make all their money from. How can they make their money if countries are bartering with one another, goods for goods? There's no way that they can actually make their money from it. So I think we can see, just by looking at the language that's used, that it was Victory in Europe Day, that we were the losers. And we only have to look around our countries now to see that we were the losers. Just look at the capital city of England, 60% non-white, and look at the laws that have been brought in to try and prevent the indigenous people of Britain complaining about this and pointing out that this is wrong. All these sneaky laws using terminology to get people's emotions going that are in actual fact ways to try and censor people and censor people's opinions and prevent people from having a political opinion that is any different to the effectively one party system that we have. I mean, they may have different names for the political parties, but each one of them supports diversity and multiculturalism. I would suggest that it was the Europeans that lost that war, and that victory in Europe was a victory for the bankers. Anyway, this news story that I want to get into today, this is a news story that never could have happened if we hadn't lost that war. If we had continued to have nationalist countries that were based on nationalist sentiment, based on the ethnicity that built the country, something like this could never have happened. And this is actually a news story from Australia. And unfortunately, it's about that same blight that we have in Europe, the non-white rape gangs. And this is a fairly old story that this actually goes back to, but it's being talked about today because the people that were jailed are being released. And there are a few different lessons that I think that we can learn from this story that I will point out. One of four Pakistani brothers who pack-raped at least six girls in their suburban Sydney home during a six-month rampage in 2002 will soon be released from jail. The man known as Mac, to protect the identity of his two rapist siblings, who were minors at the time of the offences, will remain anonymous when he is let out into the community on parole. While Mac's release will reignite anger about the series of sexual assaults he and his brothers committed on up to 18 girls as young as 13, authorities cannot keep him in prison much longer. Mac, who has 15 months left to serve of a maximum 19-year sentence, immigrated from Pakistan with his brothers in 2000, just 2 years before their rape spree began. So they can't even use the excuse that he was born in Australia. They moved to Australia 2 years before raping up to 18 girls. And this was four brothers that did this. A whole family of Pakistanis that did this. You can't say that this is a rogue individual. This is an entire family that were involved in this. And they haven't been deported. They're going to be released back into the Australian community. How is that a government that cares about its people that is going to release these rapists back in amongst the people? I mean, you could look at this and the left would say, well, this is hate speech because it's pointing out that these Pakistanis are likely to rape people. But as a nationalist, I point out that it's the government that allowed these Pakistanis to move into Australia, and it's the Australian government that is allowing them to go back into the community where they may well rape again, rather than deporting them. The people who are to blame here for these rapes are the Australian government, and who is the Australian government made up from? It's made up from Australians. It's made up of white people. We are the people that are to blame for this, and we are the only ones that can change it. This accusation from the left that we blame immigrants for things. We don't blame immigrants for things. And as we'll see from this court case, they don't see that they've actually done anything wrong because this is just culturally acceptable to them. From January to July 2002, the siblings lured teenage girls to be raped in the family home they shared with their doctor father at Ashfield in Sydney's Inner West. At the time of the rapes, Mac was 22, MSK was 23, MRK was 17, and MMK just 16. They were joined in the crimes by a Nepalese student known as RS. So what does that tell us? That tells us that another non-white who wasn't a part of the family, who wasn't a part of their culture, he joined in this as well. So it must be culturally acceptable where he's from as well. And this happened in the home of a doctor, somebody who is one of the most highly educated people in society. And these rapes went on in his home. And we're told that these refugees and the asylum seekers, that a lot of them are doctors and scientists. Well, quite clearly, that doesn't prevent them from still allowing this sort of thing to go on, even if they're highly educated. And as we'll find out, it wasn't as if the doctor didn't know about this. The doctor did know that this was going on, that his sons were raping young white girls. At the time, the brothers were described in the media as probably the most violent, prolific gang rapists Sydney has ever known. Their modus operandi was simple. MMK would befriend a girl and then invite her to the family home, which was decorated with posters of semi-naked girls for a party. Before raping the girls, who were often picked up from train stations by Mac and MMK, the brothers would ply them with alcohol. And I'm not going to go into the details of what they did. They basically threatened to stab them, drugged them. The fact that the home was decorated with posters of these semi-naked girls tells you that the father, the doctor, knew what was going on here. And when these girls would get there, there would be nobody else there for the party. The brothers usually targeted Anglo-Saxon Australian victims, who they would call sluts, as they were being raped. The girls would be assaulted repeatedly, often at knife point, and told they would be killed if they reported the brothers to police. MSK falsely told one 13-year-old girl before he raped her that he had strangled a girlfriend and hung her from a balcony in Iraq. MRK violently defiled one rape victim while she was comatose and gave another two black eyes while stealing her purse. He threw one girl against a wall and told her, "If a leb wants to F you, you F them." That comment appears to have been a reference to the earlier crimes of the SCAF gang rapists, in which a victim was told, "I'm going to F you, leb style." So this isn't the first time that something like this has happened. Now, don't forget what we're talking about here. We're talking about Pakistanis doing this to Anglo-Saxon victims alongside a Nepalese student. And now we're being told about a Lebanese gang that did the same, that were called the SCAF gang. So let's learn a little bit about the SCAF gang. Bilal SCAF led a gang of more than a dozen young Lebanese Australians who committed four pack rapes on six teenagers in Sydney's southwest in 2000. One of the victims, an 18-year-old woman, was raped 40 times by 14 gang members over 4 hours in an attack coordinated by mobile phone. She was then dumped at a train station after being hosed down. During her ordeal, the woman was called an Aussie pig, told she was going to get it leb style, and asked if leb c-word tasted better than Aussie c-word. Judge Michael Finane compared the SCAF gang's depravity to outrages committed by invading armies in times of war, and said their crimes were worse than murder. Now, how true a sentence is that? This gang raping phenomena that we see is similar to outrages committed by invading armies in times of war. Could it possibly be that that's how some of these non-white rape gangs see what they're doing? They see it as they are engaged in a war against whites. We do know that they think of it as a rape jihad. They want to see the countries turned into Islamic countries, and their mullahs encourage them in this. They have the birth jihad as well, producing as many children as they can. They have the terrorism jihad. They have the jihad of changing the history books in the schools and demanding that that children are taught false histories about Islam, that whitewash these sort of things. I'm amazed that this judge compared what they were doing to outrages committed by invading armies in times of war. Again, to be pointing that out, nowadays you could be accused of a hate crime for that. But how did this outrage happen? It couldn't have happened if the governments hadn't invited these people in. Judge Michael Finane said these were not random attacks. and in my view, they were aimed at creating terror in the community, Judge Finane said. Could we say the same about these grooming gangs that we now have in Britain? Is that what they're trying to do? Create terror in the community? And as well as creating terror in the community, on top of that, people that speak up about it, the whistleblowers, are the ones that get into trouble with the police. It's like they're protected as well. They create terror in the community. They terrorise the young girls. And then the very people the young girls should be able to speak to for help, the police, they ignored them. And he points out here that these were not random attacks. And of course, all these attacks that happen upon somebody white by a non-white, and if there's nothing to actually link them, they always get reported as a random attack. But there is one thing that black or non-white attacker will have known about their victim, and that is that they were white. I mean, that could be the only thing that they know about them, is that they are white, and they attack them. And in that case, it's not a random attack, is it? And this judge is pointing out these were not random attacks. It seemed clear to me that these men were sending out a message to the community in Sydney. Scaff and the members of this gang clearly wanted public recognition for what they had done. None of the rapists ever expressed any remorse for their crimes. And we see that same phenomena in these grooming gangs today. We don't see them expressing any remorse for their crimes when they're in the dock. Getting back to this current news story, because that was this Scaff gang, the Lebanese gang. Now we've got this Pakistani gang. Police would later discover the brothers had been filming their depraved acts against the teenagers. Videotapes showed perhaps a dozen victims who were never found or did not want to make statements. The officer in charge of the investigation into the rapes crimes, Detective Leading Senior Constable Tony Adams, described the brothers as like a pack of animals. Again, today, if you were to point out that these non-whites that do this sort of thing are animal-like, you could be accused of a hate crime. This is the Daily Mail that is pointing this out. I point out that the only reason this could happen, as I keep saying, is because our governments let them in. And we knew that some of them behaved like a pack of animals. We have so many reports of it throughout our history. It's not like they were unaware of what went on in these third world countries. Their pastime was to go out and pick up as many girls as they could, and if they didn't consent, they would basically force it on them, he said. The videos reminded me of a pack of hyenas around a carcass. The Kay brothers behaved outrageously during their trials, claiming in the face of strong DNA evidence to be the victims of a police setup and an anti-Muslim conspiracy. So what we see here is these people that are obviously guilty, they're still going to accuse the people making the accusations of being racist, of being Islamophobic. And how can you protect against that? If you have these laws that are there to prevent the indigenous people in a country from speaking up against what the foreigners are doing, obviously any foreigner that's accused of a crime is going to accuse the accuser of doing that. They're going to accuse them of racism. And as we know, you don't even need to have any evidence behind that. Just the accusation itself is seen as proof enough that somebody is a racist. They said all the barristers believed Muslims were rapists, and they wanted 6 million Islamic jurors to judge them. Before the brothers' first trial in 2003, a law was rushed through Parliament to stop Mac and MSK from personally cross-examining their victims. And apparently they did cross-examine their victims, which was horrific for them, basically. They sacked their lawyers, causing trials to be aborted, and MSK called the jurors who had to endure their histrionics effing racist dogs. MSK aborted one trial by shouting details of his previous rape convictions to a jury. So, you know, they're obviously proud of this. He threw broken glass at a victim's mother after jumping from the dock. The brothers were assisted by their father, a doctor who was given the pseudonym HMK and who provided alibi evidence for his sons, which juries found to be false. I mean, you imagine if a white father and his sons were accused of rape like this, he certainly wouldn't be supporting them. He would be disowning them. HMK, that's the doctor, treated his court appearances as a joke, giving ridiculous answers to questions under cross-examination and causing his sons to laugh in the dock. While giving evidence in relation to two rapes, Mac and MSK, committed, the Crown Prosecutor asked HMK, "Everything you have said about the night from start to finish is a pack of lies, isn't it?" HMK replied, "It's the truth, but we don't always remember. Can you put a machine in my brain to recollect it?" After Mac and MSK had been convicted of rape, the father said of the two victims, "What do they expect to happen to them? Girls from Pakistan don't go out at night." So this is obviously culturally acceptable to them. If they see girls that are out at night, they think that that's okay to do that to them. The logic of these non-whites, they see white girls and they say, well, they don't just stay with one man for their whole life, so what does it matter if somebody else has sex with them? The idea of a girl actually having to consent, that doesn't come into it. It's just the fact that because they don't, our women get divorced and they don't stick with one man for life, they think, well, what does it matter if somebody else has sex with them? And that's all they think about, is whether a girl is a virgin when she gets married. The idea of consent and that a girl that's out on her own at night, she may not want to have sex with somebody that does enter their heads. That's not a part of their culture. This is what he's saying here. Girls from Pakistan don't go out at night. What did these girls expect to happen to them? MSK had argued his behaviour was influenced by alcohol and cultural conditioning. His father also claimed in court that his sons did not know the culture of this country. And I believe him. We should believe these people, what they say in court. He's saying that his sons were acting in the sort of way that would have been acceptable in Pakistan. And our governments know that. Our governments knew what went on in Pakistan and India and Africa. And they still allowed these people to come to our countries. They are the ones to blame for this. These young lads, they probably didn't know that what they were doing is wrong. They've got instincts. Their instincts are telling them to do something. Their instincts are obviously natural. And in the country that they come from, indulging in those instincts is not a crime. But it is a crime in our country because it's wrong. It's evil the way we look at it. But the very fact that this happens and this is accepted in their culture tells us that they have a different concept of what evil is to ourselves. They are not the same as us. I'll tell you who is the same as us. Our governments that brought them in here. We can hold them to blame for this, and righteously so. Mac, now 40, has been eligible for parole since July 2016. And his maximum 19-year sentence expires on July the 31st next year. On Thursday, the State Parole Authority announced it intended to grant him parole so that his reintegration into the community could be managed. So, insult on top of injury there. The Australian government is going to reintegrate this animal into the community. And I'm using the language used there by the detective. This animal is going to be reintegrated back into the community. He should have been sent back to Pakistan for this. Or he should have been executed. If he was to do this to another man's wife in Pakistan, he would have been executed for it. These people, they just think our countries are a joke, that we allow these things to go on and we then punish the whistleblowers that point this out. And when they hear that the police are deliberately not investigating crimes where these non-whites have raped white girls, they see that as tacit approval of what they're doing. They see it as Allah has blessed them. Allah has blessed them that they can go to this white country, they can rape at will, and the police won't investigate the crimes, and the police will actually prosecute the people pointing out that the crimes have occurred. They see it as a miracle that's been given them from Allah. And what it really is, it just shows you how evil our governments are and how corrupted our people have become, that their loyalty is no longer to their people. Their loyalty is to their greed. This is why I say all you have to do is avoid temptation and you won't fall prey to the wiles of our enemies. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.